Hello, I'm Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. So 50 years ago, right now, was officially the Summer of Love. This is when most of America became aware of what some called the hippie phenomenon, or flower power, love children, all of that. To many, it was a great excuse to tell a joke, to roll eyes. Some parents just tore their hair out when they saw what was happening to their own children. People were experimenting with drugs. There was a significant amount of protest in certain areas. It was a big summer. The Summer of Love, though, was actually just a small segment of this. Many people think that the hippie experiment is something that crashed and burned or fizzled or, again, just turned into something we can joke about today. But really, for a lot of people, particularly a number of baby boomers, this is something that still lives on in their skin, in their psyche. And now that we are celebrating 50 years from that most august event, I thought it would be appropriate to talk to someone who was in the trenches of that particular happening, that era. His name is Danny Goldberg, and he is the author of In Search of the Lost Chord, 1967 and the Hippie Idea. A little bit about Danny. He is a long time in the music business. He's an executive who began his career as a journalist. The New York Times calls his memoir, Bumping Into Geniuses, My Life Inside the Rock and Roll Business, an engaging, droll, and largely demystifying look at the evolution of the rock trade from Woodstock to grunge. Since 2007, Goldberg has been president of Gold Village Entertainment, whose clients include Steve Earle and Against Me. He is also the author of Dispatches from the Culture Wars, How the Left Lost Teen Spirit. We welcome to Common Threads, Danny Goldberg. Hi, Danny.
Hey, how are you?
Fine, thanks. Fine. Appreciate you being here. My first question is this. Now, I'm going to set something up, and it's going to sound like we're not even going to talk about the book, but we are. But have patience with me, if you would. So I'm president of Interfaith Dialogue Association, and I give a lot of talks here in the West Michigan area and beyond about the idea of interfaith, world religions, how we all share a chunk of the same pie. And a few years ago, I was giving a lecture at a suburban high school. And this particular suburb, which until recently was farm country, is pretty white, pretty Christian, in a little bit of a bubble. Nothing wrong with that, but that's a fair description. So I'm talking about the religious makeup of Grand Rapids and the local environs. And people are asking me different questions about different groups. And one guy raises his hand, and I call on him, and his question is exactly put this way. What's up with the Jews? What an interesting way to put a question. What's up with the Jews? I didn't know whether he was asking about their theology or their history, or maybe he just wanted to find out if they were free for dinner on Saturday. I don't know. But the way I answered the question was to talk about how impressive it is that a group that really has no more, I believe, than 2% representation in the general population is usually at the forefront of so many areas in our society, in science, in medicine, in the arts, in finance. And not only are Jews participants, but Jews tend to assume leadership positions in so many of these areas. And I don't have a great answer for all of them. But when I think of music in particular, for instance, the genres of blues, R&B, and jazz. Now, you have Jews who are participants, meaning they're musicians, but you also have people who are the chroniclers of movements, the people who write the books about it. They tend to be Jews. Now, I'm wondering if someone who reads your book, In Search of the Lost Chord, and even, of course, even before I read it, I knew this. So many of the people who were at the forefront of this countercultural revolution were Jewish, the people who were the leaders, such as your Abby Hoffmans, your Allen Ginsbergs, your Jerry Rubins, your Bill Grahams. I mean, really, there's such representation, and I'm wondering if you, who is also Jewish, might be able to tell me if you see any reason that so many Jews were a part of this countercultural movement, and not only a part of it, but actually were true thought leaders in this. That's a big question, I know, but give it your best shot.
Well, I don't, obviously, I have no idea, but I'll try to think about some possible ways of thinking about it. For one thing, I mean, I guess to be Jewish in America in the 60s, there were sort of a few things going on. And of course, the first thing one has to say is that Jews are not at all a monolithic group. Like Christianity, there are many different versions of Judaism. And, you know, the family I was brought up and was pretty secular Jewish. We were not a member of a temple. I wasn't bar mitzvahed, nor was my brother. Although, you know, we knew our name was Goldberg, and, you know, the awareness of the Holocaust and the history of anti-Semitism on the one hand, and some of the other traditions intellectually and politically on the other, were kind of in the atmosphere that we grew up in. But you know, one thing when I think about this that comes to mind is that what little I got out of an extremely limited amount of Jewish education was the idea of no idol worship. You know, there's a passage, I guess, when Moses is leading the people out of the trying to find the promised land, leading them out of Egypt, where I guess he saw some of them worshiping a so-called golden calf. So my assumption was always, this is metaphorically, it doesn't particularly matter to us today what happened a few thousand years ago in a desert. What matters is there a spiritual teaching connected with that story? And to me, the golden calf stood for materialism, and the other idea was that there was supposed to be a relationship with the formless, infinite spirit, which some of us call God, and not to have intermediaries. And therefore, that creates a climate of questioning of secular authority, and kind of there's a sense of entitlement that comes for some of us of trying to think of our own values and ideas about things, and not necessarily listening to whoever the school teacher or the president is at a given moment in time, or the richest person in town, or, you know, et cetera. So I think there's a sense of questioning of authority that's built into the tradition that might have helped create that climate. But I really don't know. It is interesting. Certainly a lot of people that were part of that culture weren't Jewish. I mean, Tim Leary was Irish Catholic, and Robert Kennedy was Irish Catholic, and Martin Luther King, who to me is a major figure in the 60s, whose spirit permeated every aspect of it, was a Baptist. But there's no question there was a higher percentage of Jews in the counterculture than in the population writ large. But other than those notions that I mentioned, I have no particular explanation for it.
I think you've given a very thoughtful explanation, quite frankly. And of course, you certainly can't say that these Jews, the ones, for instance, whom I just listed, and some of the others in the book, they were not always on the same side in every single issue.
No, there's no pope in Jewish tradition. It's really, you know, the old joke about Jews is four Jews, five opinions. There's not a monolithic group. In 1967, which is the year I decided to chronicle in this book, which kind of to me was the peak year of the counterculture. It's before things turned so dark with the assassinations, but when they had already reached a certain peak in terms of mass media engagement of a global millions and millions of people in cultural ideas that previously were just sort of bohemian ideas in small communities. And one of the things that happened in 1967 was the Six-Day War, which you know, in the Middle East, where Israel won against its neighbors, took a lot of territory. Today, those are called the occupied territories. That fact continues to be a source of contention and controversy. But even in 67, there was some division in the Jewish community. There were Jewish Zionists who felt that the interests of Israel were their preeminent value system, and there were sort of Jewish socialists who felt that moral values were their preeminent idea, and it divided the Jewish, you know, not that there was, you know, a cut-and-dried moral answer to what happened, but not everybody agreed on that. So that was the beginning of a split in the American Jewish community that previously had been pretty unified, at least on the subject of the Middle East. But I don't really know what to say. You know, the biggest divide in the 60s was generational, not based on religion, that younger people had grown up in a different world, in a more prosperous America, in America where television was omnipresent in their lives, and where they'd seen the beginning of the civil rights movement and the possibility of change. And, you know, younger people tend to find each other regardless of what their religious backgrounds were. And older people tended to be somewhat threatened by these rapid changes, regardless of what their ethnic backgrounds was.
Oh, that's...
And the phrase the generation gap was coined to describe that exact phenomenon.
Tell us about your particular journey from middle class resident of, was it New York or New Jersey?
I grew up in the suburbs of New York, in Westchester County, and I went to high school at a school that's in New York City in the Riverdale section of the Bronx called Fieldston. And that's where I was from 1962 to 67. I graduated in 1967. You were kind enough to say I was a mover and shaker or something along those lines about the 60s culture, but I was really more of a wide-eyed spectator. It was only some years later when I got engaged in the music business and got to meet some of the people I was impressed with. So I was kind of writing this from the point of view of someone who was impressionable and impressed, and it's like a journey to all the things I wasn't quite cool enough to be part of myself. It's not a memoir, but a history. But but I do frame it with some personal observations because I just thought it's so subjective. You know, no two people remember the 60s the same way, and I wanted to be honest about what my perspective was. And it was, you know, middle-class guy from a secular Jewish family, you know, with an intellectual bent. And I guess in high school, I would say I probably had what today they would call ADD. I was someone that scored high on IQ tests, but had a really hard time doing my homework and constantly disappointing my teachers. I was not an athlete. I was very shy socially, and I felt quite isolated inside my own head up until, you know, sort of the summer of 65, when I went to my parents sent me to a Quaker camp, and it was the stirrings of the anti-war movement, a little education about the pacifism, awareness that there was this new music that was topical. I heard this Phil Oakes song called Love Me, I'm a Liberal, which was a kind of a sarcastic critique of the Cold War liberalism that was so engaged in the war. And then when I got back to high school, I quickly found the kids that were already smoking marijuana and tried as quickly as possible to become friends with them, and succeeded. And what I discovered, for better or for worse, I think for me it was better. Everybody had their own journey, and this was not good for everybody. But for me, this sort of counterculture, the idea of some of Bob Dylan's more esoteric lyrics, the Beatles, the getting high, the anti-war movement, the idea of criticizing this power structure that we'd grown up where we're supposed to just worship the accumulation of wealth and status and good grades and external accomplishments that seemed spiritually empty to some of us. You know, to me, I went from being kind of isolated and all alone and having no friends to feeling I was part of this community of a few million cool people we called ourselves heads, we called ourselves hippies, then we had to jettison all those words because they were co-opted by the media. But there was this sense of community that really changed my life. And it was associated with a value system that I still pretty much subscribe to today, which is kind of a vaguely socialist kind of politics, a basically pacifist belief and a belief in a personal spirituality that connects with the God that I think is in all religions but is not the sole province of any religion, and very consistent, I think, with your interfaith philosophy. And, you know, those beliefs went from being obscure to being mass culture almost overnight, because the mass media was quite interested in this gigantic baby boom generation because advertisers wanted to reach us, and therefore, you know, these ideas that previously were kind of obscure became pop through the mouths of the Beatles and Allen Ginsberg and some of these other people that you mentioned.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Common Threads on WGVU-FM. I'm Fred Stella, and with me today is Danny Goldberg. He is the author of In Search of the Lost Chord, 1967, and The Hippie Idea. I think what's fascinating to look back on this, and I'm having similar memories as you are, however, I'm a few years your junior, and I remember people of the so-called greatest generation feeling that people in our generation were a bunch of ingrates, that they had come back from the war and they had created this wonderfully sumptuous society. They have given us everything. We didn't have to grow up worrying about Hitler coming and taking over our country. We didn't have to worry about a depression. And we had everything, supposedly. And yet we essentially gave everything the finger and said, no, this is not what we want. What are your memories about how perhaps your parents and other people of that older generation, how they reacted to what you were doing?
Well, I think there are different categories that have to be taken into account. I mean, in the political realm, my parents and I never had any disagreements. My dad served in World War II. He was part of the invasion of Normandy. I think he was D-Day plus 8 or 9. You know, was then later part of a platoon that liberated Buchenwald concentration camp. Was glad that he served and never really wanted to talk about it, you know, much because of the, you know, he had some painful memories and didn't want to glorify the idea of war. But we knew he was a veteran, and he was certainly very grateful for the GI Bill that paid for him to go to college, and you know, was very, very glad that the United States and their allies won World War II. He also, and my mom, felt that the accomplishments of that you mentioned were mostly done under the leadership of Franklin Roosevelt, and that after Roosevelt died, that tremendously powerful government that he had helped grow, that had accomplished those very things, was taken over by people that didn't share Roosevelt's values, that were more that created this Cold War mentality, starting with President Truman dropping not one but two nuclear bombs, involved a level of conflict with the Soviet Union, which many people think is different than the way Roosevelt might have handled it, and a and encouraged the growth of a very intimidating FBI under the leadership of J. Edgar Hoover that was repressive to people that criticized anything about the culture. And so it wasn't the same America after Roosevelt died. That's what I grew up hearing in the political realm. However, my parents also were tremendous admirers of education. I believe that was the way out of poverty. That was the way out of being uncivilized. I think that, by the way, is intertwined with a lot of Jewish traditions, and to the extent that Jews have done better in some parts of society, I think that tradition of reverence for education is a big part of it. And we see that with other ethnic groups where education is heavily stressed and who do well in business and other things like that. But so they were quite upset about my lack of respect for my teachers, that I dropped out of college after a few weeks, and they were quite upset about the use of psychedelics because, you know, they just had grown up hearing that drugs were all kind of like heroin and that people who did drugs became junkies and that this was the way towards disgrace and an early death. So I think they were quite upset about that part of it. They were quite supportive of the political part of it. They supported the civil rights movement. So every young person had different families and came from different backgrounds. You know, Tom Hayden, who was Irish Catholic, you know, came out of a conservative family in Michigan that went to the pulpit of Father Coughlin, a notorious anti-Semite and critic of Roosevelt, and yet he became a radical thought leader. So the different people came from different backgrounds. But in my own case, my parents were supportive, and we agreed politically until the day they passed away, and they were quite upset with the cultural rebellion, although once I got the job working for Led Zeppelin and was making a decent living, they calmed down and realized that somehow the weird choices I'd made had worked out for me.
That always helps. Yes, a nice job. Let's talk about the beginnings of that fascinating intersection of Haight and Ashbury. 'Cause you were there, maybe not quite on the ground floor, but pretty close. Am I correct?
Well, I felt I just missed it. I felt I got there just as the curtain came down on the essence of the spirit that had really galvanized the nation. It all happened very, very fast because, you know, even though there was no internet in those days, there was television and photographs and the sheer exposure that the Haight-Ashbury community got killed it, because the influx of people, you know, just changed the ecosystem to the point that the originators left. What I mean is this, that in 65, you know, there was the neighborhood Haight-Ashbury, the main attraction of it, as Jerry Garcia of the Grateful Dead would say, was the rents were very low. It was an area in San Francisco that, you know, bordered the Fillmore district, which was mostly African-American. It was near some universities, but it was a low-rent area. You could rent these kind of old Victorian houses for like $1,000 a month for the whole house, and it'd be six or seven bedrooms, so, you know, it was maybe $100 a person, $150 a person, and it became a magnet, you know, as neighborhoods do at different times in history in different places for creative people. San Francisco had a long legacy of nurturing kind of bohemian artistic ideas. Allen Ginsberg had first read his poem Howl there, you know, and, you know, it already had that kind of aura. And, you know, sometime in the end of 65, some rock and roll musicians moved in there. First, the group The Charlatans, who didn't become famous, but who were a leader in it, and groups that later became the Grateful Dead, the Jefferson Airplane, Big Brother and the Holding Company, Janis Joplin's groups, you know, all kind of moved there. A lot of college art students were there, and it became one of those neighborhoods that were cool. We see them today in different parts of the country, but this was also the same moment when LSD was entering the mainstream of society. LSD had been around since the 40s. The CIA actually had experimented with it in the 50s, seeing if it had use in the mind control drug in warfare. Ken Kesey, the author of the novel One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, who became one of the most famous sort of popularizers of LSD, first took it, given it to him by a CIA program in Northern California. And, you know, Henry Luce and his wife, who were the owners of Time and Life magazine, you know, the most powerful magazines in America for decades, both took LSD as part of some legal government program in the 50s. And even though they were fierce Cold Warriors who opposed the Vietnam War protests, were quite enthusiastic popularizers of psychedelics in the pages of their magazines. And this all kind of crystallized in the San Francisco area. And so by 1966, you had the first so-called head shop that was selling books about Eastern mysticism and highly colored posters that we would now call psychedelic, and accoutrements that made smoking dope easier, and a number of other stores that just sort of were catering to this subculture. And it took on a mushrooming effect because of the various trends in the society, and became a high-profile neighborhood in January of 1967, when there was something called the human being, so which got attracted 30,000 people to Golden Gate Park at a sort of a program that was emceed by Allen Ginsberg, include performances by all those San Francisco rock bands as well as a lot of kind of mystics and poets. And that got international publicity. Before that, Haight-Ashbury was just sort of a thing that people in other bohemian communities knew about and was kind of becoming known in San Francisco. But that quantity of people and the hundreds and hundreds of photos that were taken there and the news coverage it was given created the high-profile image of Haight-Ashbury that led to what later that year was called the Summer of Love. And the Summer of Love really was the end of Haight-Ashbury, not the beginning of it. Because by the end of the summer, August, when I got there to go out to school at the University of California, Berkeley, Haight-Ashbury was creepy. So you had junkies, you had a lot of predators, you had a lot of homelessness because the neighborhood could not accommodate 100,000 people. I mean, it was a neighborhood, you know, of a few thousand people, and the city was not interested in accommodating them. So Haight-Ashbury pretty much was finished as a cultural vanguard by the end of the summer of 67. But for the 18 months leading up to that, it was the center of a lot of creativity and a magnet where, you know, whether it was Rudolf Nureyev or the Beatles or writers or artists, you know, philosophers from all over the world wanted to go there to get a sense of what this kind of communal alternative was that was being talked about there.
You've been listening to Common Threads here on WGVU. Our guest today has been Danny Goldberg. He is the author of In Search of the Lost Chord, 1967, and The Hippie Idea. Please join us again next week here on WGVU-FM. I'm Fred Stella.